everyone. It's Naomi Wolf of Daily Cloud, and I'm really happy to be welcoming Dr. Paul Alexander. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So Dr. Alexander is someone I've followed for a while because he's been outspoken, trying to get, in my view, a broader discussion about vaccines and especially about the vaccination of children. I'm going to read a bit from his Wikipedia page, which, as I joked before the camera started rolling, it's clearly as slanted as my Wikipedia page is, but it identifies him as a former Trump administration official at the US Department of Health and Human Services. He was an aide to HHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, Michael Caputo, and he's now an independent researcher and most recently was published a letter, was published in the BMJ, correct? Yes. Right. So I would like to start with your views on children and vaccines. Tell me what your thoughts are about this.
Well, Naomi, once again, thanks very much for this, this very esteemed forum. So let me get straight to the point. So we are still in the throes of this pandemic, and let's not make light of it. COVID-19 has been devastating, but a very specialized group within the society, in the sense that very elderly, we knew very early on, we saw the data globally that COVID was very amenable to risk stratification, and that your baseline risk really determined your future sequelae, so that baseline risk was prognostic on your mortality. And what that means is that we found that generally the person at risk was the elderly person with underlying medical conditions, or even if you were younger and you had serious medical conditions. But we argued for a more focused, targeted approach because we realized that when we looked at the data, it was very settled and clear, well over a year. So that when the CDC discusses children and vaccines today, and they discuss this is a, we have now realized and we have now analyzed it. And that's been actually very disingenuous because we've known this data for almost a year and a half. Mm. We knew very early on that children were at very low risk of acquiring the infection in the first place. And this has to do with a combination of factors. One being that in their nasal epithelium and upper respiratory tract, children do not harbor the receptor, the ACE2 receptor at the numbers. It's not expressed like in adults. So there's this age gradient. So children have limited ACE2 receptors. So it limits the ability for the pathogen to infect children in the first place. Also, we have study research that shows that children are protected by prior exposure to common cold coronaviruses. So we were understanding as time went by why children were at such low risk to acquire infection in the beginning. We also found in the data very stably that children do not spread to other children readily. They do not spread to adults. They do not take it home because we found that the infections actually originated from home clusters from adults to children, not children to adults. Mm-hmm. And we also found very stably that the sequelae in children is not severe illness or death. So
what does sequelae mean for non-specialists?
How the disease unfolds and the progression over time, particularly if it's becoming more severe. Mm-hmm. And this was very good news because what that told us is, unlike seasonal influenza, let's give an example, COVID spared our children. And that was very, very good news early on because influenza is much more catastrophic to children than COVID. Wow. So our argument has been that in the camp that I am with, I mean, Naomi has already, Dr. Wolf has already stated that I was a past, prior attached to the Trump administration, Health and Human Services, in the offices of the Secretary and Assistant Secretary of Health. But, so you would assume that my position would be for these vaccines, given they were developed within the administration. But I mean, I was early on, whilst they even against the vaccines, and particularly focused make it only focus on high-risk groups, very elderly people, not the general population who are low risk and well, given we had other opportunities to control this and reduce the risk in those populations. And my position remains this, that the vaccines are untested for safety. They were not followed for the requisite time. We need 10 to 12 to 15 years to bring a vaccine from conception to your arm. But we've done this in 2 to 3 to 4 months. And the safety arm of the trial, where you follow the vaccine in the subjects over many years so that you could exclude harm. And what we mean by that is, so that when you make the statement in the end to the FDA and the FDA makes the decision to authorize it, you are saying that we have followed this over the correct number of years and we can now conclusively exclude harms. Right. So that if your child takes this vaccine, of course there will never be zero risk of anything in any situation, but the chance of something happening that is severe is very minimal. Right. Well, today you are asking your child to take a vaccine, your teenager, et cetera, infant, to take a vaccine where we cannot in no situation say we could exclude harms. Why? Because they just did not study it. And that's the mind-blowing thing about this. We do not have the data.
We don't have the data. So let me jump in there because I am not a medical doctor and I'm not a specialist. I'm just a reporter and I'm a mom. And I keep thinking about the history of women's health, which I have written several books about. And the history of women's health is a history of things that women were told were awesome and safe and fine that turned out later to have unintended consequences and side effects, whether this was too high levels of estrogen in contraceptive pills leading to, or the side effects of contraceptive pills leading to blood clotting, whether it was thalidomide, whether it was Mirena, which had to be withdrawn from the market, whether it was vaginal mesh, which has also been withdrawn from the market, silicone breast implants, so on and so on and so on. I mean, the history of women's health is a history of things turning out to have needed more study. And the thing that blows my mind as an advocate for women's health is that we don't have data on lactation, we don't have data on pregnant women, we don't have data on miscarriages in terms of this vaccine, right? The mRNA vaccine specifically. So leaving that aside for a moment, you're noting correctly from everything I followed that children are not at great risk from coronavirus. You're noting that this is an untested intervention. It's different from ordinary vaccines. From what I understand, it has a different mechanism, right? It's got a different methodology, and which to me says you need to test it, you know, even more in some ways than more traditional vaccines. And you're saying that, and then I'm asking, why is there this huge push given that young adults are not at serious risk, teenagers are not at serious risk, and children are not at serious risk? Why is there this maniacal focus on vaccinating young adults, teenagers, and children?
Well, Naomi, there are two things. I wanted them to answer that quickly. I want to touch on the issue of herd immunity, which was the falsehood, and I would use the term lie, that was told to the American people by Dr. Fauci, etc. They said that the population cannot get to population level immunity, herd immunity, which protects the rest of the population, unless children are included in that mix.
That's it.
And that was put out there, and that is a total falsehood, because to accept that statement by them, and they know, this is the challenge here, the CDC, the NIH, Fauci, et cetera, they know that what they're saying is an untruth, is a categorical untruth, because to accept it, you have to disregard that there is not already protection that people in the population already came with due to prior coronaviruses exposure, children prior exposure to common colds, the larger society itself. And we know that figure is around 15 to 20%. That's on the board. So put that on the table. Secondly, if you accept that in America, 35 to 40 million people have lab confirmed infection, which is what is advertised every day as they do these infection counts. The CDC itself has put out official statement that actually it's a 6-to-1 ratio approximately, where for every one lab confirmed, there are about 5 or 6 people in America who have escaped detection. So if the number is 35 million, you're really talking about 200 million Americans have already been infected, and therefore they have in some manner cleared COVID and are now immune.
Okay.
When you add those numbers together, those portions, you are getting 70 to 75% of the population already have some protection. So that when Dr. Fauci says that we need children to get to the 70% herd immunity number, he's being disingenuous because we are already there. Many states were already at herd immunity. We saw from around the middle of December to the end of December to the beginning of January, all of the hospitalizations, the ICUs, the deaths across America in different states were coming down steadily. We saw this even before the first shot was put in an arm. So really and truly, any benefits that you try to accrue to the vaccines, you have to understand that it's partly due to the population grinding out natural immunity on its own. Plus, there was this issue of early outpatient treatment, where a lot of doctors in America were actually taking the initiative and being very brave and treating patients early with antivirals, et cetera, to prevent hospitalization and death. So there are many, many factors in that.
Right.
We don't need children to protect the elderly, actually to protect adults. It's adults who normally in a society protect our children. So this is so wrong-sided and upside down and very reckless.
Well, thank you for that very clear explanation. And again, as someone with, you know, eighth grade biology, it is so baffling to me that all these discussions about vaccination leave out prior infection and the body's natural immunity, which is a great miracle of, you know, the human condition and part of evolution. So let me ask the question again from a political perspective, because you've been inside, you know, the HHS and you've been inside the communications shop of the HHS, as I understand it, you know, kind of how the sausage is made. Asking it again, given that children are not at risk from COVID, given that you've just persuasively argued that we don't need to throw children's bodies in the mix to get to herd immunity. And anyway, I think there's a moral problem, even if that was not the case, of using children to protect, you know, adults. I agree with you about that. But all of that being the case, why then this push to vaccinate children and young adults? And let me throw in one more thing. I'm worried, you know, very worried about the menstrual problems that women are having. And I'm very worried that I get emails every day from women saying, you know, I'm having 2 periods a month. I can't tell you how many times I've had emails saying I had 2 periods in a 20-day period of time. Women saying I've had a period that's lasted for 30 days. Many postmenopausal women, like years postmenopausal, are saying, I was vaccinated and now I'm bleeding. And many women talking about severe cramping and blood clot, like passing tissue. So why would there be such a push to vaccinate young adults and children, not only given that children are not at risk and young adults are not at serious risk, but given that there may be side effects we don't know affecting fertility if there's this much dysregulation of menses?
Well, first of all, let me just make sure it is clear in this interview that I'm not a clinician. But I mean, I know enough about the science. I mean, I'm dealing with this every day with different groups across the world, and we are in the COVID situation. The reality about it is, before, we did not know what was happening with the vaccine in the sense that when you took the shot in the arm in the deltoid, the idea was that the vaccine would remain in the shoulder, in the arm. The immune response would be mounted there, and there would be limited vaccine spread throughout the constituents of the vaccine throughout the body. But we got to find out across time that just about 25% of the vaccine stays in the arm, in the deltoid, the muscle. About 75% enters into the bloodstream, and we're trying to figure out the mechanism for how this is happening. Why? Because we found out that the spike protein that our the vaccine, the whole program promotes, that to get your cells to generate and produce a spike protein, we found out that the spike protein on itself is a pathogen, in the sense that it is very toxic to the vascular system, particularly the endothelial lining of the vasculature, particularly in the small capillaries that surround a lot of these organ systems. And that is what has caused the flurry of blood clots and irregular bleeding and the myocarditis that we've now found in teenagers who've gotten the vaccine. And you know, there's also this issue of the reports of vaccine of spike shedding. And we found out now by some research that the spike is coming out in the sweat glands, etc. And while it has not been studied formally yet, there are women, and again, I'm not a gynecologist, but I'm just saying, there are women who are reporting just what you just said. They are beginning to have irregular periods, irregular bleeding, and some very, very serious matters. And they have not even been vaccinated. And they are coming into contact with people who've been vaccinated. So these things need to be studied. And it goes back to what we were saying in the beginning. If somebody walked up to me and say, and asked Paul, why would you conclude that the vaccines are potentially unsafe or untested? Well, I would have to respond that, well, because we did not test them. Right. No, so that's the answer. Right. So if somebody says, well, you can't prove that these women who are having these irregular situations or making these severe reports are due to the vaccine. Well, the answer would have to be, well, you can't prove that it is not due to the vaccine, because the vaccine manufacturers have not done the required studies and for the duration. How could you follow something for 3 months and circumvent 10 years of time and tell me that you've gotten the same information? You absolutely cannot. And regardless that I was connected to the prior administration, I'm against what has happened here, because based on just proper science, this is nonsensical. It makes no sense. You cannot show me that it is safe based on that time of follow-up. And we have very serious problems. Look, the VAERS system, which is the CDC's reporting system for adverse events post-vaccine, we are seeing about 6,300 deaths linked to the vaccines temporarily. So that means, and about half of them are happening 1 to 2 days, 48 hours post-vaccine. So temporarily, they are mixed, they're linked. They're happening right after the vaccine, huge spike, and then tapers off into a tail. We have hundreds of thousands of adverse effects being reported. And so this is a very serious thing, and no one is studying it. It's almost like a silence in the media. And until we bring it, unless we bring it out, and contrarians or skeptics, that we talk about this, it's not that we don't want the vaccine to work. We want anything that would help save lives. But we have to face it that there are some serious questions here that have to be addressed.
Just a note, very well put, just a note that menstrual dysregulation and these severe menstrual consequences are not even categorized in VAERS, from what I understand. They're not broken out separately. I have researchers looking at VAERS, and they have to do very complex kind of sifting through the data to even find reports that could be, the kinds of things that women are reporting. They're you know, when women say to their doctors, I'm having all this menstrual dysregulation, the doctors are not, from what I understand, being encouraged to make a formal report to VAERS. And I do not see that you can lift out or look at, you know, the incidence of these menstrual disorders on VAERS with any ease. Let me push again a little bit. Why do you think there's this silence in the media? Why is no one studying these adverse outcomes? Why, from everything you've just said, it would make good public policy to make these somewhat, well, certainly not fully tested interventions available to the elderly, to the immunocompromised, to, you know, support the kind of targeted sheltering that the Great Barrington Declaration proposed, that you proposed, that Dr. Atlas proposed, and get vaccines to people who are really at risk. Why? What politically is driving this push, or is there some economics driving this push? Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, in normal politics, if I'm the CDC director and I see that there have been over 6,000 deaths temporarily linked, right? We don't have a smoking gun to post-vaccination. And I see that, you know, young adults have an elevated risk of myocarditis and, you know, which is terrible. I would say, you know what? Let's pull back and study this more. This is a catastrophe, you know, it's too risky. Let's make this vaccine available to people who are really at risk from COVID. And otherwise, let doctors prescribe it, but not have $1 billion in overcoming vaccine hesitancy in the last stimulus bill, right? Millions and millions of dollars through the Gates Foundation, which is separate because he's invested in this, to news outlets. But if I were the administration, I wouldn't be, or if I were Dr. Fauci, I wouldn't be out there every day saying, your kids have to get vaccinated. We're gonna vaccinate teenagers without parents' consent. Like, that seems so explosive politically and so unnecessarily risky. So what is the politics behind that, to your knowledge?
Well, I mean, you know, when you speak about these things, sometimes people say, well, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, or you're just a kook. You're not thinking about this, etc.
You and I both worked in or near the White House, and we know that there are calculations to all of these things. But go ahead.
But the thing about it is look, in 1976, I believe, under the Ford administration, there was a swine flu pandemic. And there was a vaccine program where I think about 45 to 50 million Americans were vaccinated. There were 25 to 50 deaths linked to the vaccine. And that vaccine program was stopped. It was stopped because of those 25 to 50 deaths. Right now we have closing in on 6,500 deaths, and no one has stopped this. So you have to ask yourself why. Yeah. Why when the benchmark was 25 deaths for prior vaccine programs in the United States to be stopped, why is this going on? And to me, sitting in there is money, because right now they're talking about boosters. So what they're trying, from my point of view, is you're gonna take your two shots, and then every year you're gonna have to take a booster, etc. And that's gonna cost, people are gonna make hundreds of billions of dollars with this. So, of course, there's a financial gain for all of the parties involved. And that's a troubling aspect of this, because you don't want to get into how business is operated or curtail people's profits if it is legitimately earned. But in this case, you're talking about a vaccine that, an intervention that could set our children and our young people and our society up for disaster in times to come. Look, this is no speculation here. Post SARS-1 that occurred in 2003, there were many research studies tried on similar type vaccines for coronaviruses. Mm-hmm. And when they did these vaccines and they inoculated the animals in the trials, and the animals got inoculations, got these similar type vaccines, and the antibody levels were very high, and everybody was happy with it, and thought everything was a success. And then when they released the animals into the natural environment and they faced the wild type virus, they basically died, and the trials had to be stopped, and those vaccines did not go to humans. So the question is, what happened here? And we're getting a lot of troubling reports that the animal phases of the study, the prerequisite studies, certain toxicology studies were not done by the respective companies here. And that has to be examined fully, because if that is so, that's a real troubling situation, because we do not have any proper safety data to tell us what we are putting in our arms. How is this going to behave long-term? And we're not just talking about today, we're talking about long-term. And I believe there's a lot of interests in this, special interests in terms of the financial gain. And, you know, it just changes the discussion when you think that could financial people who have money to make and financial gain, could they have that much clout and power that they could cause government officials and governments to relegate the safety of the population? And that is a very frightening concept. And, you know, we have the philosophy now that this had more to do with just getting vaccines in people's arms, and from there, your second shot, and from there, your booster. And here's the thing, Naomi. The reality is that when you think about this vaccine now, and I am not a purist vaccinologist or immunologist, but I know enough for my education, etc. I think it was nonsensical and absurd and just a failure for them to make a vaccine that gave our immune system one target, which was the spike protein, where most of the mutations are taking place. When natural immunity exposure looks at the entire viral ball and all of the proteins on the surface of the virus, including the spike, and builds a much more robust, durable, long-term immunity. So you've made a vaccine that on face now we are seeing a lot of breakthrough infections. A lot of people who've been double vaccinated are becoming infected with COVID and the different variants.
Right.
That means that the immune system is not recognizing the changes on the spike. And that is happening because you give the immune system a very limited, very narrow spike-specific immunity, right, which the immune system is laughing at. I mean, the new variant is laughing at and blowing past your immune system.
Right.
So it just makes you think, did they set this up in the beginning to ensure that with the emergence of variants, you would have to take new vaccines, you would have to take repeated shots and boosters every year, etc. So it raises a lot of very troubling questions, very, very troubling.
I have to say, I agree that those questions have to be raised, because one of the first times I was deplatformed from Twitter, it was when I posted Moderna's kind of marketing brochure. And the marketing brochure compared traditional vaccines with the mRNA vaccines, and the competitive advantage in the case that Moderna was making basically to shareholders and to the financial markets was, you're gonna need a booster. You know, this is, and they used the software of life, you know, and they used the metaphor. I've been attacked for quoting them and citing their metaphor, but their metaphor was, there will be regular, you know, updates of this platform. And by reading, and that was an advantage to traditional vaccines where it's just one shot and then you're done. And reading their financial marketing materials, I said, there are going to be repeated shots for this platform. That's the case they're making to the financial markets, you know, about why this is a better investment than Johnson & Johnson or a more traditional vaccine. And that turned out to be true. And now I'm deplatformed from Twitter, but that's a different story. So I hear you, and that's very scary. Let me ask you one other question about the spike protein. Where does it go? Right? Like I was also recently deplatformed because some wastewater managers were talking about how our wastewater system is not set up to deal with mRNA byproducts going into our, you know, wastewater systems. And a doctor had said, well, a spike protein is broken down in the digestive tract. And then I asked, well, where does it go from there? So let me ask you, how does the body get rid of the spike protein? How does it, where does it go?
Well, I mean, the idea was that when you put it into the arm, that it would migrate to the local regional lymph node and the immune response would take place there. What we found out from some data that came from the Japanese regulatory agency, plus another study by Ogata, is that the contents of the vaccine, the lipid nanoparticle that houses the mRNA code, those little bubbles, as part of the vaccine, gets into the bloodstream and goes throughout the body in places that we didn't normally think that they would be ending up, particularly crossing the blood-brain barrier, etc. We found that it's accumulated biodistribution heavily in the ovaries.
So that's confirmed? Because I had seen that study and it was debunked, but you're saying that that's confirmed?
But that is actually regulatory data. That's, I think the Canadian researcher, Dr. Brittle, who's gotten a lot of flack over this, is an exceptionally smart guy and maybe one of the top virologists, vaccinologists in the world. And when he said that the spike protein, what he was implying is that the content, the vaccine itself, the messenger RNA, the lipid nanoparticle is what was detected in the ovaries, in the testes, in the spleen, in the adrenal glands, etc. Well, you have to understand that if the lipid nanoparticle is showing up there, obviously the content of the lipid nanoparticle will be there also, which is the messenger RNA.
Right.
And that would get into the cells and the tissues at that location,
right,
and do what it's supposed to do, which is then induce your cells to produce the spike protein. So the spike protein will end up there. And but normally the idea is that the spike, et cetera, would be degraded and end up in your, like in your feces, et cetera, and you pass it out. But we've seen in like in your Gata study that healthcare workers that were showing spike circulating in their body at least 15 days from the vaccine. And that raises a lot of problems because what exactly is happening during that 2-week period? You see, the issue here is what happens here? What damage can the spike do to you? And we have evidence. We have research now that is showing that when the lipid nanoparticle gets into your cell and the messenger RNA is decoded, translated into the protein, once the proteins get built, the spike protein, and sits on the surface of your, and mainly the endothelial cells of your vascular system, when the blood flows over the endothelial, across the endothelial cells with these spike proteins sitting there, it causes the platelets in your blood to clot and clump.
Right.
That's the blood clotting that starts right there. And it also causes very, very severe and irregular bleeding problems. Dr. Bakdi explains eloquently, and he is one of the top scientists in this area, that one of the issues is that in the production of the spike protein, your cells produces a molecular type of waste product as part of the production. And this happens normally. And it places the waste product, using layman terms, at the door of the cell, of your cells. So what happens is within your immune response, in your immune system, the natural killer lymphocytes, their job is to peruse the blood system constantly.
Right.
And their job is looking for viruses or any indication of viral production, because that should not be taking place in your cells at the cellular level. Right. And once it detects this waste products, it attacks your cells. So you are having like almost a double whammy. You have the spike protein promoting blood clots and bleeding, and you have the waste product being targeted and attacked by the natural killer cells, and damaging the tissue and trauming the tissue. And that's where all the damage and the destruction is taking place. So to say that to say that today you ask such an important question, Yomi, for you to say, Paul, what happens once you inject and the lipid nanoparticles move through the system, get into your cells, the messenger RNA attaches to the ribosomes, gets translated into the proteins, et cetera. We just don't know. That's the problem. Like normally biologically or from a physiological biochemistry point of view, I could explain how this should happen in a normal circumstance. But in this case, nobody could.
Nobody knows.
Nobody could because they did not study it. They did not follow it. It's like the pregnant woman that you refer to. CDC put out an advisory a month ago saying pregnant women could be vaccinated. When you look at the study that they did, they followed women for 2 to 3 months. A small subset of women, when we know pregnancy lasts for 9 months. How could you get the information that you need on an expectant woman over 3 months of follow-up? You've not followed through the full duration of the pregnancy. You can't also make any statements on the safety and the health of the developing baby. So when somebody asks a question, it's not that you don't know. We could talk. I could talk physiology for you. I could talk immunology, but we cannot because we will get ourselves in trouble because Pfizer and Moderna and all of these people have not given us the data. They've not even done the studies for us to be able to comment fully. We are right now theorizing and prognosticating on what we think is happening, which is very scary.
I totally agree with you. I mean, when I read that there's a crossing of the blood-brain barrier, I thought of the developing fetus, and we do so much. You know, pregnant women are advised to keep away from environmental hazards and not to drink too much alcohol and not to smoke because that's such a delicate environment. And now something is crossing. If it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it crosses the placenta, right? Theoretically, yes. Right. And we have no idea. We don't know that there are healthy babies. Maybe this conversation will be completely beside the point and all of our anxieties will turn out to be for nothing, but this does seem like a giant experiment on human bodies, and human bodies are very, very, very wondrously and delicately made. And when you say the spike protein, or it's confirmed that the spike protein gathers in the ovaries, as a woman, and the mother of young, mother of a young woman, stepmother of another young woman, my question is, well, what then? You know, and when you talk about the effect of the lipid nanoparticles, if I'm getting this right, or the effect of the messenger RNA on the epithelial cells, which affects bleeding, did I get that right? Or the vascular system?
Yes, the messenger RNA is translated into the spike protein, and the spike protein damages and traumas the endothelium. The endothelial cells are the cells, and also the glycocalyx is the surface of the endothelial cells, but they line your vascular, all of your vessels throughout your body.
So the vascular system affects the uterine lining, right?
All organs in your body are serviced by a vascular system. It has a blood supply.
Exactly. But when women are talking about like passing, these bleeding problems and the myocarditis, which is also a circulatory problem, right? It sounds like you've just described a mechanism that could be causing problems with bleeding, problems with blood flow, in our organs, in the lining of the uterus, in shedding of the lining of the uterus, in circulating through the heart. I mean, I am not a scientist, but what you've just described makes what people are going through seem to make sense.